It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, listeners.
It's my crazy kid, Laurie.
Good morning. You know, after all these years, I still love that introduction. It is really, it just lasts and lasts and lasts, and it doesn't get tiring.
Oh, I know.
Maybe I'm crazy.
That's our very dear friend, Joyce Reeling. Joyce was a Broadway actress.
You know who wrote that introduction?
No.
Who?
Honey, you don't know who wrote that?
I don't remember who.
I wrote it.
It was, you wrote it?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
What do you think driving me crazy? What do you think driving me crazy came from?
I may have written the introduction, but I came up with the name, which is why we're
saying.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess I just got told.
Good morning, listeners. I tried to open the show in a genteel and charming way, and you come barreling in, Johnny. It's
yeah, well, we know I'm not the genteel, charming type, so.
You are. Hezzy, how do you feel this week? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I really am. So it sounds like I'm a little bit under the weather, but I'm not. I'm feeling very good. I checked with the doctor. Everything's cool.
That's wonderful. You did.
We had spring and winter and and winter again here.
Now it's dense fog. It looks like it's a Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah. Got up to 72 here. Like 72. We had a couple of really stunning days. Then it went back down to like 39. And now it's back up to like 50. And
it's going to be 71 and tomorrow's going to be 50. So,
yeah.
You know.
So it's kind of up and down right now.
But in any case, this week's car is, we're delighted to tell you, is the 2021 Buick Encore GX Essence front-wheel drive. And this is the second car in a row that we've had that is an auto manufacturer's take on a small SUV. This is would you call it a compact SUV, Johnny?
Yes, that's what they do call it.
Okay, it's a compact SUV.
It's bigger than the one we had the week before. We had the Hyundai Venue, and I think this one's a little bigger than the Venue, don't you?
Maybe. I'm not sure. Probably, but it's
still called a subcompact.
It's
compact, yeah.
The same class. So, what was your take on this car, honey, before I go charging in?
Well, I liked it. I mean, it is a Buick. One of the things you said in the column, though, I'm going to bring up first, is at the end you always talk about Buy American, Buy America. But look at I know you got the Monroney. Look at the Monroney and look over to the right, because most of the car is not made in the United States, to be quite honest with you. And I don't think you caught that. You didn't.
No, I knew that. But here's the thing. Until there's a change, then, yes. 3% of the car was content put together in Canada. 45% was in Korea. 26% was in Mexico.
I was really surprised about the Korea part.
I was too. I am and I'm not, but
they must be providing the engines and the transmissions to make up that much of
the transmission came out of Mexico.
Oh, okay.
But here's the thing: it's still a Buick. It's still an American brand. Until things change and the world realize that when we send jobs abroad, Americans lose jobs. When we send jobs abroad, I don't understand why they think there's a bigger profit margin, when the fact of the matter is we're doing a disservice to people that have been trained and know how to do the work just as well as anybody on the other side of the oceans. But nonetheless, that's another subject for another time. This car gets very good fuel economy at 32 highway, 30 city for an average of 31. But would like you to start talking, Johnny, about the handling of this, because it struck us both the very first time we drove the car.
Well, there's two things about it. First of all, I want to talk about the looks. It's a good-looking car.
Oh,
a good-looking vehicle is not a car. Yeah, it really does have a nice shape to it, and Buick always has a very, you know, the front looks pretty. I'm looking at the picture of it, like the one we had. And, you know, the front, I love the grill. I love the way I love the looks of the vehicle. And it did handle very well. I mean, it's when you get these, again, these smaller vehicles, like the one we had last week and this one, because they're smaller, the turning radius is shorter. And it just, if the car is stable, and this one is very stable, it just seems to handle so well. I mean, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it from that standpoint. It's actually considered, we were talking about what it is, and there's like four or five different descriptions of the size of these vehicles. And this one is actually a subcompact crossover SUV, which is the smallest of all of them. Another thing, and talking about not so much about the handling, but about the mileage and that kind of thing, it actually comes with two different engines. There's three models of this thing. I'll remember those in a minute. But it comes with a 1.2-liter engine and a 1.3-liter turbo engine. And, of course, the one we had, which is the high end of the three, the GX, Encore GX Essence, had the 1.3-liter turbo engine, which, if you're moving, I thought the car did great. You know, if you're going along and you step on it, it actually responds pretty quickly. From a dead stop, though, it takes a while for the four chipmunks to decide what it is exactly that you're asking them to do. So,
Johnny, I want to interrupt you.
Okay, go ahead.
And I'm really putting myself out on a limb here.
You already did interrupt me. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, we never, at least almost never, say anything bad about any of the cars we ever review. And it's like our good friend Bugsy Lawler always says, they don't make a bad car anymore. Here's the thing. Both you and I can't put my finger on it, so I'm asking you a question I don't have an answer for. But when both you and I drove this car, we both had the same first feeling. And that was, we love Buick. The Buick Enclave, I mean, Buick comes out with still and has for over 100 years, 120 years, come out with incredible, I mean, they're innovative, they're leaders, their quality is...
Friends of ours bought a Buick because of one of our reviews.
And got one for their son as well. The point I want to make, what was it when we got behind the wheel of this car that didn't feel quite like a Buick, or maybe didn't even feel quite right?
For me, it was the seats. That was the first thing that I mentioned to you when I got in. Now, look, I like the layout of the car, the dash, all of the features. I loved all of it. There's a lot of luxury, actually, in this vehicle. But the seats were too short. They come back behind your knees so far that, and there's no way to move that seat forward, that it was not as comfortable. It wasn't very comfortable, for me anyway. I could get in all right, didn't hit my head, any of that kind of thing. But I just felt like the seat was a little narrow and it was a little short. It was built for a smaller person than me.
And now that you mention this, I tend to be, I can tell you horror stories of why I am claustrophobic. I wasn't claustrophobic in the car. I'm not saying that at all. But I did exactly what you just said. I did feel that I was that much too close to the dashboard. I was that much too surrounded by car. I don't know what it was. It could have even just been the interior color for all I know. But there was something about that car. Now, look, we did review last week the venue, the Honda venue, and we were all about it. We could have gone on for hours about that car. We were enthusiastic about that car. And it wasn't because the price, or in part it was because the price was $10,000 less than the price of this Buick Encore GX, which is $34,000 and change.
Well, that's fully loaded now, too.
And that's fully loaded. And the car is certainly worth $34,500 and change. But the fact is, there was something about the Hyundai that excited the heck out of us, and there was something about this Buick that held us back a little. That's what I can't put my finger on.
I think it's perhaps, and I mentioned it sort of in passing, but there's a lot of luxury in this car. I mean, this thing had things that the Venue didn't have. I mean, it's got heated seats, it's got air-conditioned seats, it had heated steering, you know, outside mirrors. It had all these kind of things that you would expect in a luxury vehicle, and a lot of safety things, but they all have safety things. But yeah, it had a lot of those luxury things. But it's just like the luxury things didn't quite fit in with the size and the feel of the vehicle itself, which, again, when you get in and you sit there and the seats aren't, I don't want to say they're not comfortable. They weren't comfortable for me, again, because they were too short and a little bit stiff. But it's just, you had a lot of these wonderful things, but it just didn't quite fit together. I don't know.
Stiff is a very important word here because, you know, we're talking about the car in these terms for the first time. Johnny and I haven't, you know, and we generally don't sit down and, well, we do when we drive a car, but we generally don't pre-plan our shows because, of course, we are known for our spontaneity.
Oh, is that what we're known for? Okay.
But the fact is, when you said stiff, that kind of rang a bell with me. The handling of the car, the acceleration of the car, seemed somewhat stiff to me compared to the Hyundai, which it did what you said. This does as well, which is it takes the four chipmunks a little time to, you know, wake up and get behind the car. This car, I thought...
You go first. No, you go first. No, you go first. Okay.
But this car, I did feel, had better pickup, more spot.
Once you got it going.
Yes. But, you know, again, is this, you know, to do with the engine size? Is this to do with... I don't know. And here's the other thing. When you get a compact SUV, I don't care who makes it, SUV always, sports utility vehicle, it was born as a large vehicle. SUVs didn't come compact. They came midsize and big size. And then the compacts kind of came along as another, you know, option, an alternative to...
That's part of the crossover idea.
Yeah.
You go from a car to something that is part car and then part SUV.
And you can argue with me till the cows come home, but I don't think...
We have cows?
One day we might. You can never tell. but I have to argue about any compact SUV because in my mind, an SUV is never compact. It's a sports utility vehicle that you throw a bunch of stuff into and take a bunch of people and kids into and go places and ski or play hockey or do this or do that. You cram the dogs in. You can't put that much in any compact SUV. And I guess it just seems like an oxymoron. There's no such thing in my mind. In my head, there's a small-scale, you know, kind of four-door pumped-up station wagon, which is more what I would call a compact SUV. But an SUV to me is a much bigger, grander, and powerful vehicle that holds a lot more than anything like this Buick or last week's Hyundai Venue. I don't know. I'm having a problem maybe with the concept, not with the car. Help me out here, honey.
I don't know that I can, but I will tell you that last week we talked about the Venue as being a runabout, and this car isn't really a runabout. I mean, to me, it wasn't a runabout. Runabout, you jump into this, that, and the other thing. And because there's so many luxury things, this one had the leather-appointed seats and all the things that I talked about, and sunroof and power sunroof and power seats and, you know, all these kinds of things that you find on a more expensive vehicle, actually, in a bigger vehicle. It just, it's not a runabout, but... Again, it's a really nice quality vehicle if you put the back seats down to go anywhere and to get anything. I mean, it's a great vehicle to, you know, go to the store and get lots of groceries or whatever you might do. It's not the kind of vehicle that I see loading up with a bunch of bags of dirt, not unless you put something down in the back. Do you know what I mean?
And nor do I see it as loading it up with a couple of kids. I mean,
no, I agree with that.
This is a luxury vehicle. This is a great car, perhaps, for people like us who are, you know, are empty nesters, or actually soon to be empty nesters. Our grandson's moving out on Saturday, which is a point of sorrow for me and rejoicing for
Where's the champagne?
Well, rejoicing for our grandson, who's so excited to be getting out into the world at age 20. But still, all in all, the point I want to make is I don't see this as, you know, a beach car, kids, you know, running in from a play date with
one. I agree with you.
It's got too many luxury features. It's a terribly comfortable car as far as, and I agree with you about the seats, but it's got the seat heaters, it's got the steering wheel heater, it's got, you know, all the bells and whistles that you want as far as seat adjustments. It's got a 10-way power seat adjuster. It does have that 50-40-60 split bench rear folding seat.
Which means you can put part of it down.
But, I mean, again, could that hold a large dog crate? I don't think so. Medium one, yeah. Small one for sure. But, again, this is not a negative. If you are an empty nester, if you've never had kids and you know, do some kind of, you know, sport, if you want to, would you take this car on long, long drives, long distances?
No.
Because of seats.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, you know, it's that wonderful, wonderful story from All Creatures Great and Small, the first series. Wonderful, wonderful, with the late Robert Hardy, great actor, God rest his soul, where there's an episode and Siegfried Farnan, who is Robert Hardy part, goes to a remote sheep farm where every Christmas his
I want to see you tie this in the car. So this is going to be good.
This is going to work. Every Christmas he goes religiously up to on Christmas Eve, and the wife of the family serves her famous Christmas cake, which she starts preparing in September because, you know, you marinate the fruits and all of this for the cake and da-da-da. Well, James Harriet accompanies, who's newly employed by Siegfried Farnan, accompanies him to this farm and is invited to partake in the cake. So the family, which has like five or six kids, all dressed in their Sunday best, the husband, the sheep farmer's dressed in a tie and jacket, and the wife is about to serve the cake. The table's laid, and the wife, with great pomp and circumstance, is about to serve the Christmas cake. Siegfried's at the head of the table, as usual, to cut the very first piece. But just beforehand, the wife takes James Harriet into the pantry where the others cannot hear her, and there are two Christmas cakes. One is hers. The other was made by her sister. And James is horrified because he's afraid that Siegfried is being laid to bait, because here the wife is going to serve her sister's cake to see what Siegfried has to say about that. And so sure enough, the wife comes out, unbeknownst to Siegfried, with her sister's cake, puts it in front of Siegfried, who ceremoniously cuts the first piece. He puts it on the plate. He looks at the cake. He inspects the grain of the cake. He cleans his mouth with a small swig of brandy, and then he cuts the first piece. He eats it, and he puts it in his mouth, and for quite a long time, he's tasting every nuance of this cake. And he then takes another sip of the brandy, and he puts his fork down. And he says to the wife, and everybody is holding their breath, and he says to the wife, and this is the point of my very long story, he says, "Mrs. Jones, this is a wonderful cake. It is a delicious cake. But I am afraid it is not up to your usual standard." Whereupon the wife, knowing it's her sister's cake, claps her hands and says, "Lord bless the man!" So anyway, what I'm saying is, Buick, this is a wonderful car. It is a beautiful car. But forgive me, for whatever reason, it's not up to your usual standard in my book, because there's just something about it that's not making me as enthusiastic as I always ever am about Buicks, which, by the way, my grandfather always owned a Buick. So, again, I can't put my finger on it, but it's sometimes we have seen recently, though, that a lot of these car companies are giving, you know, they're giving away the phrase, honey, giving away the, not shop, giving away the something, or they're putting everything in that they can think of, and sometimes when you do that, you're trying to please everybody, but you overplease. I don't know what I'm trying to drive at here, pardon the pun, but there's something about this wonderful car, this beautiful car, this tremendously handsome car that has all the bells and whistles for 34 grand and change. That's just, it's just missing something, and I don't know what it is.
Okay, good. Now, let me talk about the cars. I said there were three models. There's the Encore GX and the Preferred, there's the Encore GX. The Preferred starts at $24,200. That's good. The Select starts at $24,800. And the Essence, which is the one we drove, starts at $28,600. So even if you're starting at the top of the line, $28,000 is not bad. But when you look at the Encore GX, which has the 1.2-liter engine, not the turbo, and some other things, but, I mean, it's the starting one. But at $24,000, it's pretty much affordable by anybody, okay, by anyone. And it comes with all the safety features. That's one thing, because I did a comparison across the board on these things. And one thing that Buick and almost all of the car manufacturers do, they include all of the safety features, and I think that's great. The Essence that we drove had an advanced technology package, a convenience package, a liftgate package. There was charged for the moon blue metallic paint job. It had it been upgraded to the 1.3-liter turbo engine, and all of that added $4,620 to the base price. That's how you got to $34,000. The basic Essence is only $28,000. So you're talking about $6,000 in addition. And again, when you're buying a vehicle and you sort of know what you want and you go to the lot and maybe you pick one out that's got some things and maybe it doesn't have everything that you want, I don't know. You can order them, so there may be something you want to do along those lines, but that's one of the reasons they give options. But this advanced technology package was $1,790, but it did add a lot of things I thought were worthwhile. High-definition surround vision, heads-up display, adaptive cruise control, navigation, which I thought that was odd. Navigation doesn't come standard, but navigation, voice recognition. I love that voice recognition. I even spent a few minutes talking about it. Bluetooth audio streaming ties right into your phones, and even a memory card receptacle. I assume that's for music, but I don't remember seeing that recently on any of them. But so many things now are tied to your phone that they, you know, that's the Bluetooth, the Apple CarPlay, and the Android CarPlay that allows you to plug in your phone and you can play music right through the speakers on the system, all that kind of thing.
But, I mean, don't you feel that we're seeing that almost all the time now?
Well, I certainly think it's on there more and more. I certainly think that Bluetooth and Apple CarPlay and Android CarPlay are, you know, because you can just push a button. Now they just have it and you click on it and it does all those, it hooks it up for you, which, you know, I think for people that live off their phones, which a lot more people do these days than, you know, I do, that's for sure. I'd say it's going to be a pretty common thing. But anyway, that $1,790 had a lot of things included that I thought were good. That navigation, one of the things that I learned about the navigation, about the voice recognition this time, it was a lot of what I've experienced in some of the other ones, the simplicity of it. You can't program your navigation if you're driving because you have to push buttons, which means you're not paying attention to driving. So what you do is you just push the voice recognition button, which looks like someone speaking, and you actually talk, which is amazing to me. I mean, this kind of technology to me just is fascinating. But you push the button and you say, navigate to, and you give them an address. You just say the address. And you get this pause, and there's like this wonderful voice, and it says, just a moment. And then a moment later it says, da-da-da, it gives you the address that you said, and would you like to navigate here? And you put yes, or you say yes, and away it goes, and it does all those things. And I also found out, because I was driving along, and I thought, well, I wanted to call there was a, one of the places I wanted to stop. I think it was Lowe's or one of the hardware stores that I wanted to stop by. And I just thought, well, I'll for on a whim. So I pushed the button and I said, call. And I gave the name of the store. And it was like Lowe's Hardware Store in Aberdeen, North Carolina. Do you know she actually found and said calling the store and called the number? I mean, how do they... I don't even understand how that kind of thing works.
I love the way you always call a GPS system she.
Well, it's always a woman's voice, and you know, the ones that are.
I think some of them can be programmed to be like an Englishman's voice.
Oh yeah, men or women or Australian. You can get different accents. Yeah.
Here's a couple of things that I thought were truly wonderful, and believe it or not, and you will never guess in a million years, the capless fuel fill. I love the fact that you don't have to screw off a cap, and, you know, when you're trying to fill your car with gas, it's capless, which is great. In other words, the cap is integral to the cover, the fold-out cover of your fuel filler. The headlamps, tail lamps, and fog lamps are all LED, and so are the daytime running lamps, which I think is terrific. One thing that I don't care for in any car, and this is not just this, is the stop-start system override.
Yeah, I like that, because you push the button and it stops turning the engine off.
Oh, no, I need to be corrected. The stop-start system, I like the override.
Right, I always look for, I don't like for my engine to stop when I stop at a stoplight. I'm not comfortable. Yeah, I know when you take your foot off the brake, it's supposed to start up, and I believe it will, but I don't like that. Let me say one. Can I interrupt because we're running out of time, and I want to go over the convenience package, which I thought was
good. Go ahead.
Yeah, the convenience package was $770. Again, you look at these packages, and you kind of have to make decisions about what's important to you. But the convenience package was $770, and it added automatic parking assist with braking. I don't generally use automatic parking assist, but people who do, I would think that would be worth the money, that alone. But it also, that's where we got wireless charging. And it was a really great little charging area right in front of the gear shift. There's a little, you just slide your phone in there. Just put your phone in there and it starts charging. And I thought that was cool. And then you got a rear camera mirror, not just a rear camera, but the rear camera mirror. First time we saw that was on the Chevy Blazer, I think it was. But the rear camera mirror, which actually shows what's behind you, is pretty cool. And then, here was a coup. Then it had a rear camera mirror washer, and it had rain-sensing front windshield wipers, which I like because sometimes you just start getting a rain, and if you're driving, you don't want to fiddle with the windshield wipers particularly, and it senses the rain and turns on for you. I like that kind of convenience. Anything that helps me stay focused and I don't have to deal with, I like. And then, so was it worth $770? I don't know. I would probably think so. And then there's an $850 sport touring package. That one is all about bumpers and body color and accents and 18-inch aluminum high-gloss wheels and, you know, protective molding. I don't know. You know, I don't know. The power hands-free lift gate package was $520. I think that's probably worth it because of the hands-free thing. You know, you're carrying packages, you're walking out of the store, you've got a hand, and you can open it without having to use your hands. I like that, and I like the fact that it's power. You push a button, and it closes all by itself, and it secures itself. The paint job was $495. I don't know. The upgrade to the 1.3-liter turbo engine was $395. I didn't drive a 1.2, so I can't tell you the difference, but, you know, the 1.3 was adequate. It wasn't great, but it was adequate. And so that's why the 28.6 became actually $33,000, and then you got a $1,000, $995. You got a $1,000 destination charge, and that's how it went from...
It's a destination charge.
Yeah, 28 to 34.
Now we really do need to wrap up, honey. Our time is up.
Okay.
We'll be talking to you all next week from the road. Johnny and I are actually taking a road trip to upstate New York.
Road trip.
And we're going to be driving the new Lincoln Corsair.
Right, 2021 Corsair. Lincoln Corsair, which is an SUV.
Yeah, we're very excited about that. And, Hezzy, You stay well. We'll talk to you next week.
You too. Have a safe drive.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, Hezzy.
Be well.
Take care.
All the best. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you and goodbye. All right, how exciting. Well, so there we have it with the Buick Encore GX Essence front-wheel drive for 2021. Oh, and let's see, we've got Brian Harrod on the line. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. I'm doing well. And yourself?
Thank God. It was a pleasure. And then I'm feeling better because you're on the line. We should tell people that you are the publisher and editor of Yonkers Newswire. So that's exciting. How does that all fit in? How many years have you been doing this as Yonkers Newswire? It's quite a while, isn't it?
In Yonkers, it's been maybe 5 years or so, but previously I had been more active in other communities. There's a total of, on social media, there's a total of 350 pages for hyperlocal pages for communities from, they cover basically all of Long Island, New York City, Westchester, Fairfield, Putnam, Lake communities. Mm. And it's just, I just enjoy locating news and then classifying the news, especially by location, trying to get it hyperlocal in a community like Yonkers.
Yeah. And do you also find, because I find Yonkers actually very exciting. You know, it seems more exciting than you would expect. But a lot of stuff happens, a lot of good stuff, a lot of maybe questionable stuff, but it's constantly ticking away. You know, it's not like where everyone's sleeping.
You know, I'll put it this way. It's when I cover other communities, let's say I'm covering Port Chester or White Plains or Putnam County, mm-hmm. or you know, Bedford, what have you. You know what I'm saying? Larchmont.
Right.
There's a flow of information, and it gets covered pretty well by either a local paper or, you know, LoHUD, News 12 and stuff. It's not so hard to cover the information. But you start digging in Yonkers, and there's just all this stuff that's happening that you don't know about right away. You know what I'm saying? Or you didn't know,
right.
Why, my God, that happened last week, you know? So I'm constantly surprised. You know, sometimes by the time I'm putting stuff up, because I'm kind of aggregating news, I've already heard about what happened in Mamaroneck, you know what I'm saying? But in
mm-hmm.
Yonkers, it's every day, like, it's something new. It's, you know, it's the fourth largest city, and there's you providing, a local news website. But there's no daily paper, there's no radio station, there's no television station. But if we weren't sandwiched between Westchester and New York City, it would be quite a media location. Being it'd be like Rochester or Syracuse or Albany, you know. So it's there's no radio station. There's nothing. Well, I guess there's your station. Thank God you stepped in to create a little bit of a station or a presence. So
it is interesting, but do you think that we're going to be going back to print paper since you brought up this issue? Are we going to go to print? It looks like print is waning. And I don't know if that's because it's print or because maybe the media outlets that have been publishing in print have somehow reduced the capapacity of their employees who are reporters. Maybe it's a lack of reporting rather than the fact that it's a newspaper. Because also a lot of people my age who are a little bit older, they happen to like the print. But I think I got over that about 5 years ago. I always wanted it in print. But then I think the internet is just as comfortable for me now.
I am like you. I'm a dinosaur. I do like, even though if you know, to pick up a New York Times or a New York Post or other paper, Wall Street Journal, I found highly, you know, very well written. It costs almost as much as a book now. You know, you're paying $3, $4, $5 to read the paper. But I do I do enjoy reading the paper. Now, for younger generations, let's say somebody's like I don't know, just turning 18, it's hard for them to grasp the concept that, you know, they used to, you know, at 10 o'clock it was start the presses at night, you know, and then something big happened overnight, you know, stop the presses and let's correct this stuff. And they would print all this up. People would go to a printing plant, and then they would load up their cars, and they would drop off bundles in neighborhoods, and kids would pick up the newspaper and, you know, like ride on a bike or carry it and throw it on your porch, and you would go out in the morning looking for it in the bushes. And it was very inefficient, but it's just hard to imagine people see that. And you just don't see it much. They're just not available even in retail outlets like drugstores or gas stations or places
That's true, too.
You know, even candy stores or convenience stores that sell these things. But but people have still, there's a small group of people that have a, they think it's good I was in the newspaper or something, or they want to clip it out. But like you say, that's waning. You know, it's every year it's less and less, and we're probably talking about, you know, 15% of the population that thinks it's important to be in a local paper, you know, and it's probably going to be less than 10% another year or so. It's quickly being diminished. And the sad part of it is these news organizations that, you know, were based on print are very slow to change their ways and to adopt new technologies. And it's killing them. You know, they're slowly now just starting to, if you go on like News 12 every morning, this is what I wrote on my Facebook page. That's what they're saying. You know what I'm saying? or I get posts from writers at LoHUD. You know, if it happens to be a story about Yonkers that they want to post it on the Newswire, and I allow to post, but that usually about every you know, every two or three days they write something about Yonkers and they come here and they post it personally, trying to get people to notice their work. But LoHUD doesn't put any effort into being on an online presence like, say, yourself does, or myself or others. It's just they just don't adapt well. That industry is. As much as they can criticize other industries for failures, they can't look at their failure to transform, you know, in this changing world.
Well, you know, one thing that I found efficacious, if that's the right word, when you looked at print and you would read an article, let's say one of the lead articles, and it would go from the front page maybe to page two. When you got to page two, there was something – could have been analogous to the front page story or was completely different. When you go to a website, you usually go to, I guess, the lead story on the website. And I thought that you didn't get introduced to a different subject. So I guess Google and all those other search engines wouldn't show you something else that was different. So what they did show you was similar stories, which I think truncated your ability and your scope. But I'm starting to even get used to that now, so that I would have preferred, like, okay, one story which would lead to something completely different. It would expand your ability to understand what's going on in the world, and or it could, and I thought that was the way to go. But maybe things are getting better. Maybe the Google search and all the other search engines are getting better and giving us a little bit something a little different rather than the same thing over and over again.
I've had a couple of debates with people, actually politicians mostly in Yonkers. They lament that, you know, the weekly paper has died. LoHUD doesn't cover us. News 12 doesn't cover us. The news industry's dying. It's not like it used to be. There was so much better news, in the news industry before. And I tell them, how clueless can you be? You're in the middle of a news and information renaissance. You know,
right.
Every day I'm putting up 24 stories about Yonkers, news, information, and events. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then there's other people doing the same thing and covering things I don't cover. There's you getting It's almost like every other week there's like you think you're meeting somebody in a garage, like Deep Throat giving you some inside information of something that's going on in City Hall. There never was. If you go back to the 90s, 80s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 40s, there never was this flow of news and information about Yonkers. There is so much news and information, it is not even funny now. People are better informed and potentially have the chance to make better decisions in their community. And it's right on their phone. It's right on their phone whenever they got a moment or two free to read about what's happening in Yonkers. And but you never had that before, you know. And I think the powers that be, it was easy to control two or three news outlets, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But it's not easy to control what happens now, you know what I'm saying? So
exactly. Very, very interesting. But what a segue. We have so many other subjects to cover.
Yes.
So my apology. Well, one thing you did bring up, which is also very compelling and telling, was St. Patrick's Day only yesterday, and yet we didn't have the parade that always goes down McLean. And that was pitiful. You know, it's amazing. You know, it's the holidays that tell us how COVID has informed us in a negative way, because I missed the parade. Hopefully, next year it'll come back.
You know, as they vaccinate people, I think it's going to be a few good years. You know, we've softened the blow of this, what would probably have been a potential depression from this pandemic with this stimulus. But I talked to a guy the other day. He was saying this fall he has four weddings to go to because they were supposed to happen in 2020 or early 2021. I'm thank God I'm not on that kind of a social calendar, but four weddings, to attend and what have you and do all this. So there is a pent-up demand, and I think the parade, when it hits next year on McLean Avenue or along Fifth Avenue, it's going to be huge. I think as the celebrations slowly come back online, it's going to be huge. People, I'm not one to go out and eat and try this restaurant, try that restaurant so much, you know what I'm saying? But there's such a pent-up demand, they just want to go out. They want to go to bars, they want to go this, and I'm old now, so I hate to go to anything, you know what I'm saying? I hate to, if I have to leave my house, it has to be a good reason, you know, can you imagine if you're young, you know, if you're 20 years old and you want to go out there and meet girls, and what are you going to do, meet her on Zoom? I don't know. This is horrible, you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's got to be, these kids, I know they just can't wait till things open up, things happen, they're going to want to do things and try to make up for what they lost, you know what I'm saying?
I agree. I think the people who are hardest hit are the young people. They're the kids who are in their teens, the grade schoolers, and even the early 20s. It probably the most overwhelming for them because they want to go out and they want to be with friends, and it's important for their socialization as well. So hopefully it doesn't turn out to be bad, but it's been a tough year. And, people don't see their grandparents and they don't see their friends, and they can't go out and play. It's just really amazing.
There's been a theory kind of touted around a little bit Well, I guess the last pandemic 100 years ago was in the just before the Roaring Twenties. You know what I'm saying? And it just shut everything down. There was so much death. You had World War One and that, and it was just, right up from after that pandemic and things opened back up, it was just gangbusters. So there is a clique of people now to think, you know, what we might be the 2020s might be the new Roaring Twenties or something and you're seeing a lot of that optimism in the stock market now. You know, it's record level after record level after record level after record level. Right. Is it like they used to say, what's his name? You say irrational exuberance, or is it
exactly.
Is it, something really there? But I have a feeling, you know, I'm not excited to go get on a cruise ship, but there's people that are excited to get on a cruise ship. I'm not excited to go fly somewhere, but there are people that want to get on those tubes and fly across the country, you know. So, and I think they will. As soon as it's doable, I think they will.
They probably will. Well, there are some things that happened specifically in Yonkers, and you wrote about it, and that was the deadly gunfire that had erupted, and with regard to an emotionally disturbed man in Livingston Avenue. And that was covered, actually. I guess the police were very comfortable because they did such a good job. They were being shot at. They returned the fire. But then at the end, this person killed himself. That's got to be very traumatic, especially for the police. I don't know how they handle that sort of thing. Because I'm sure they wanted to take him alive rather than to see him kill himself.
I will say this. You know, despite sharing, there's some things I would say about the management and the leadership of the police department and how the police officers are deployed. You know, like the dispatchers don't even know where a car is. They don't even turn on the GPS. Like, car is here. Go there as quick as possible. Right. It's issues like that.
That's true.
I've been highly critical, you know, maybe not having a foot patrol downtown in Getty Square to help this area come up, those kind of things. But the one thing I will say I am impressed with, and it's anecdotal because just things I've seen, but the officer on the street, and there's been a lot of new officers too. One, they're highly trained in Yonkers. They're trained very, very well, and they seem to be very disciplined. That's number one. Number two, they, from my perspective, you know, and I'm not a person of color or haven't lived here a long time, but they seem to be, in a lot of situations that I've noticed, been able to de-escalate some things. So and even in this thing where there has been gunfire in a very public place or in a neighborhood, they seem to react and take care of it pretty quickly. So I assume the training kicks in there. But like you said, it's the number of incidents an officer has to see over time, or one as traumatic as this, has to have some kind of effect on the person. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to be put in the position of finding a person that committed suicide and after a gun battle too, just have all the emotions you'll go through trying to process all that.
Yeah. Well, there was something else that happened as well. I think you expressed it very well when we talked about this this episode on Livingston Avenue. And there were evidently some overdoses that took place, and it was laced with fentanyl, like cocaine. Are we seeing a resurgence of that? Because I thought that went away 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, but maybe not. What's your take on that?
The previous one they had a notice like this a little over a year ago was in the Bronx and on McLean Avenue. It was kind of like an Irish group that had, you know, this all of a sudden there were people going to the hospital from in Yonkers and in the Bronx. Now, I don't know what group, who this is associated with this time, because the press release wasn't that clear. But the it obviously is a problem with you know, the opioids, the heroin, and the fentanyl. It's just apparently it's a very strange thing, you know. I don't really like taking medications much. You got to push me to take something. I don't know. I'm just leery, I guess. You know, they're medical marvels, but I'm just afraid, I guess, of some things. But you can get you can take an 80-year-old grandmother, give her opioids, and she won't get addicted. But you can give some lady that's 30 and it seems like one pill, and she's got to have it, got to have it, got to have it, got to have it. So there's some kind of something in your makeup that makes you, I guess you're predisposed to be addicted or something, you know, or have a different kind of outlook on life.
True.
But
that's true. It's a medical thing.
But I don't know. It's just, but it's apparently, they're currently, I guess, settling up with the country and setting up a trust to pay back for all these costs that this opioid explosion has caused. Mm-hmm. And this heroin addiction is related to that, which is, and then they add this fentanyl to give it a little extra kick and I guess to improve sales, but sometimes the mixture is lethal.
What I didn't realize was that if you take fentanyl, it could affect you in a very, very negative way if you don't die.
Hmm.
So
oh, really?
I had no idea that it could be, that was part of the story. You know, I don't know what it does to you, but it's a sad way to go, that's for sure. Something that's uplifting, though, and you reported about that, the COVID-19 vaccine is now going to be, age-wise, it's going to be reduced from 65 to 60. So that's going to add a lot more people who could be, you know, immunized. And I think that's, you know, we're starting to be able to do a better job of that, too. It's amazing how quickly we're ratcheting this up. And then older people are also even getting it.
They talk about, you know, I got it then I got my shot before you or what have you. I just turned 60, but when I applied, I wasn't, it was still 65, but, I have weight. I have a little extra weight on me here. I'm a little overweight. So was a condition that would allow you to go ahead and get the medication. So a little bit of a Rubik's cube, you know, does someone have diabetes? Does someone have high blood pressure? Do they have a certain amount of body mass, that type of stuff that would let you go in and get the shot if you weren't 65? But pretty soon, I guess it'll be pretty much 18 and over. So once that happens, it won't be so hard to figure out, can you get the shot, where do you get the shot, that kind of stuff. But they're pumping them out in Yonkers, 1,000 a day. So it's you do that for a month, it starts to be real numbers.
Absolutely. Well, it's got to get done, that's for sure. One thing that was really quite tragic, or rather, before we get to the tragic thing, maybe something to celebrate. The schools are thinking of now going to a four-day program with regard to hybrid student learning. And why is it only four? You can do four, can't you do five? What's the rationale behind that? Because doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it's entailed with the extra day, but I do know last night at a board meeting, they passed it. It passed unanimously. The board says we're opening. I think April 5th it might be that they're opening up the four days.
Yeah, April 5th.
And if there's not enough room to move the desk like 4 feet apart or so, they're going to put up plastic shields around the desk. The student will have like a little. It'll kind of be contained in his desk,
protection.
That kind of stuff.
Right.
But I'm not really. It's not been much discussion. That's a good question. You look for the important details, but I'm not sure what they're doing on that fifth day. You know, it just. I'm not sure. I assume. I don't know if they go remote or if it's just 4 days is enough for you kids. I'm not sure what it is.
It doesn't make any sense, you know.
Yeah.
Kids need to socialize. They need to interact with a teacher. So if you could do 4 days, which should have been anyway the case from the very beginning, you could certainly have done 5 days. And there's your week, your full week. And then what's interesting is the kids are not the ones that are being infected. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're not the source of the infection. It tends to be the teachers who get infected, and they're the ones that might spread it to the younger kids. The younger kids also seem to be less susceptible to being infected, And it's the adults that tend to be more easily infected. What I also found interesting is, why are we opening up the school to a four-day program on the 5th of April? We got April, May. What, we got 2 months?
Yeah. I guess it could be a dry run.
Why did it take us so long?
Well,
Who's the idiot to figure this one out?
Well, I'll say this. When it first happened, like a year ago in March, and, you know, this was there, it was spreading like wildfire, and people were trying to figure out, you know, even what the science was, I was opposed to any kind of going to school or any, you know, activities like opening up a golf course or what have you. But as time went on and we got into the fall and they got a good grip on this virus and kind of understood where it came from, that it was from bats and how it affected the body, and that there were trials for vaccines, and there were a lot of there was time to measure exactly what had happened, especially since there were 50 different states doing 50 different things. You could compare and contrast, I guess. But when it came time to go back to school, or when it did there, the teachers were all for, you know, being scientific when it was stay home. But then when it was time, the science is saying, you know, now with further study, it looks like we can open these schools. They were highly opposed to it. They, I guess, prefer to do remote learning at home and not travel to the classroom and interact individually with the children. They say they don't feel safe. So I don't know. It's
Maybe they don't feel safe, so then they don't have to come to school. They're sick. And if that's what they thought, then they should have gotten inoculated. I don't know if they all have. What I find really compelling is, there was such a tremendous need to go back to school, especially because our student population didn't have the wherewithal, financial or otherwise, to buy a computer or a handheld device or Chromebook or something like that. These machines were on order from September of last year. None of it has shown up, because it's all BS. If they ordered it, they never had the money set aside for it, so they don't have the money. So why do we just go into a four-day program when it was pertinent? If you don't have the computer systems or computer access, doesn't it make sense that we should be going back to school and therefore the kids can learn because they don't even have the computers?
Yes.
So what's the point? And why are we doing it only for 4 days instead of five?
I wish I knew what was happening at this day, but I have no idea what's happening.
It's not for you to know, and it's not for me to know, but it's for them to know, and they don't know. That's the thing that I find frightening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it shouldn't. And it's a scientific policy, and we need to figure it out. Also, the fact that you're only going to a four-day program instead of a five-day program also puts a lot of pressure on families who can't go to work. What do we do about that?
Yeah, no, I think there's. I'll say this. I think it's the right move to open the schools, and I've had that position now for a few months. Previously, I was leery of opening the schools because we just didn't know what you just. It was like a big unknown. But once the science came in, it looked like it was safe to open the schools, then I'm for it. But there are forces in Yonkers that are not big about opening the schools. And unfortunately, maybe a union is more concerned about its members than about the students, sadly. But that's the fact. You know, our members want X. But it doesn't matter if what your members want causes harm to the students. And so
that's what I don't understand. Again, if you can open up for 4 days, you can get infected in the first 4 days that you're working, and maybe you could even get infected on the fifth day, even when you're not in school. So what I don't understand is then why aren't teachers regarded as the first responders? If they have to teach, shouldn't they be inoculated?
I believe the pharmacies can only give shots to the teachers and maybe people that are above 65. You know, anything that's been opened up, they can go
forget
to
about
like
the 65. We know about the 65. We're talking about the 30, 40, 50-year-old teachers. That's what we're talking about. So
my understanding is the shots at the pharmacies are only for the teachers, and plus they can go to the regular places. But it was set up that way so the the people we're talking about was difficulty getting in, getting the phone call, getting the shot.
Right.
So like if it's at CVS or Walgreens, if they go to those places, the teachers will be inoculated. They get the priority there, just like how Yonkers initially got the priority for this armory site for like a week or so, and it really benefited a lot of people in Yonkers. So I guess the union should probably focus on getting their teachers to these places where there could be shots for them. And it is not that difficult. You got inoculated. I got inoculated. People are getting inoculated 1,000 a day in Yonkers. So it's very doable.
Yeah, except they're doable, except I'm 71. I'm not 30 or 40. But if the teachers are supposed to be inoculated inoculated, then therefore they should be going back to school, not on April 5, but they should have gone to school even at the beginning of the year or the end of last year. So I don't understand this mumbo-jumbo when we should be going back to school, because what the teachers' union, if they've been the ones promoting it, what they've done is they've undermined people who need to go to work, who can't because they got to take care of the kids at home, and they don't even have the computer systems, so a lot of them are teaching from home, and I don't know if they're capable of teaching. Some are, some aren't. I don't understand this stupid little game that we're playing, and at the end of the day, if we don't even have the computer systems for the kids and the machines haven't come in, then what are we trying to do? And the only thing we can do is to compensate for not getting the computers is where they could have been taught at home through the computer system, then it's for the teachers to have been inoculated. Were they all inoculated? That's the question.
Did they have enough time to get
inoculated? Takes no more than a month to be inoculated from the first injection to the second. So what was the issue?
They're very good questions.
The
good news is, I'll put it this way, that in the stimulus bill, the city schools, Yonkers Public Schools, get $69 billion. It's just a windfall, new money. And I know there's issues that we got to do this, got to do that, COVID cost this, whatever it was, but maybe they can set aside out of this $69 million bucks, maybe enough money to put a computer in each of these children's hands in case some variant comes back and throws it back into a shutdown again, or B, just to help these kids catch up, you know, instead of a new textbook, let's get them a new Chromebook and have enough Wi-Fi that these kids can excel even.
I agree. If we stop buying books that are published in print, the cost of maybe one or two of those books is the cost of a Chromebook. So why are we spending money with publishers and keeping them employed when we could have easily gotten the Chromebooks? Because you can get the Chromebook between $100 and $150 a piece, which we never got, even though we said that we would. Then the other thing is we need to be in school the whole day, and it's stupid to open up on the 5th of April when we're going to be shutting down, was it April, May, and June? So that doesn't help very much. And then the question is, why haven't the teachers been inoculated? They could have been inoculated at the end of last year, the beginning of this year. So I don't understand the game here, but it doesn't make sense. Even the cost, first of all, we should be able to get free Wi-Fi for all these kids. instead of $15 a month, which is outrageous. Because then we don't need those type of, these franchises from these companies in Yonkers or in anywhere in Westchester County. Throw them out on their rear end. Say thanks, but no thanks. But if we needed to buy, internet access, book would pay for it for a whole year.
Yeah.
One book. So I don't understand what we're doing. I mean, it doesn't make sense anymore. I'm a thinking individual. I'm not looking to blame anybody. I want solutions. And the only way to find a solution is to see what the issues are and look for a resolution to it, which we're not doing.
Well, I'll tell you where it one of the big failures of Yonkers has been with Fios and with Cablevision and with other people that wanted to provide, like you say, the franchise services. They have failed miserably. If you go to White Plains or you go to Mamaroneck or you can go to Greenberg, there's like a cable commission. There's somebody that's responsible for the cable services. And, there's drops for nonprofits for, like if I'm running a program at, say, like Nipperhead Community Center, there's a drop there for free and the children can get online after school, or at the police or the fire, those type of things, right? So, and then, then there's the public access studios. People can go in Greenberg and, say what they want. They say they're 15 minutes of what they want to say. They can do it every week if they want. They can go into White Plains and they can sit down in a studio and say it, and it's a paid for by the cable company. They can go into Larchmont Mamaroneck and say what they want to say, do what they want to do, make whatever programs they want to make. And it appears on the channel, but if you even when Cablevision wanted to needed to get permission from Yonkers to change their name to Altice, and they were going to these communities one by one, making deals so that we could do this, a lot of communities said, you know what, we need this, we need that. If you're going to do that, then we're going to need this. You know, you haven't been doing this lately, let's fix that. But Yonkers, sure, no problem. You know what I'm saying? But it's even the for the public access for the school is abysmal. You know, it's just these board meetings and these endless promotional pieces about the superintendent and, these little notices. But you never see nothing that the kids make. You know, they supposedly have a studio. They supposedly are learning about these kind of arts. But you never see the programs that the kids make on the education channel.
Mm-hmm. No, we never do.
Yeah.
Because they probably don't do it, that's why.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice to see what our youth thinks about certain things? And maybe if they had a project where they're going to set up teams of kids and they'll make their own documentaries about what they think about Yonkers, what they think's good, what they think's bad. I would love to see what their perspective on thing is, but we don't use our public access that way. Our public access is cutting a ribbon in front of some place. It's not letting this older person or this younger person or this person who feels disenfranchised being able to sit down and have a commentary or to interview somebody about an issue. You know, it's just not done in Yonkers, but it's done in the city. It's done in St. Louis. It's done in Buffalo. It's done in Rochester, Albany. You can go in Albany.
But we can't hear you. We're starting not to hear you because you moved your phone. So we have only got about 7 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about the Alamo Draft House, which is a movie theater chain of 40 chains across 40 places across the country. So evidently they filed for bankruptcy. You noted in your article that Fortress Investment has agreed to buy the company out of bankruptcy. But the fate of the Yonkers location is unclear. I never went to it, but I heard that it was very popular for a few years, so it's a shame to see them close. But have you heard at all if this company, Fortress Investment, might consider opening up the Yonkers facility? Was it profitable? I have no idea.
I have no idea either. I had not been, but I'd seen all the publicity about, you can have a beer and watch the movie or eat some right. burgers, I guess, or whatever, and watch the movie there, and they'll this table service. But
COVID that caused them to shut down. Is that the reason? Less
I'm
people were
so.
Allowed to come in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Want to do one more
I do
thing
know,
because it's important.
Okay.
The Yonkers Idol 2021. You write that it's a 3-round competition. Kicks off this Saturday, April 10th at Untermyer
yes.
Park. And there's now even a junior idol for those 10 mm-hmm. through 14. How popular is that? Because I hear it always was, but I never really got notice of it when it was going on. Those
yeah.
after the fact.
Yeah, I've also heard, it was very popular. And, of course, it's a nice activity for children. It's like good, clean fun,
sure.
you know what I'm saying? To be involved in this competition, and who knows, they may actually one day discover an idol. Like 10 years from now, they might be saying, over in Altamira Park, she took off her mask and she blew the town away.
Right.
I'm just glad that they're able to. I assume they'll tape each one, and then hopefully they'll show it like on the public access or something. But. I'm just glad that the kids are able to engage in that activity of the kind of like the singing arts. But it's just
right.
The good news is you're starting to see these little bits of things slowly coming back. You saw a little bit of it. You had some Irish dancers on McLean Avenue. It wasn't a parade, but you had some dancers. And then, now you've got these
right.
kids that are going to sing at an empty park. But it's slowly coming back.
Yes. It's very exciting. So, what else is on your docket, so to speak? What are you up to now for the next few days? Cleaning house.
today, believe it or not, my wife wants to go see if the stimulus came. She's got the retirement
okay.
income. So yes. After I leave the phone, it's a big job. She wants to go grocery shopping and stimulus. So that's occupying my next 3, 4, 5 hours. But otherwise,
well,
I just
stimulus,
kind of, like you said before, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can you check with the bank if the money came in?
Oh, good. As much as I talk about the other media companies need to join the 21st century, I still am a Luddite. I like using a flip phone. I like writing checks. I have never taken a picture of my check and deposited that way. I take it to the bank and deposit it. And so I do use an ATM. So I assume her money has hit the, from the Social Security has hit the machine there. So I guess she just wants
right.
confirmation of that the money's there or what have you. But otherwise, I hollered all the other people, but I'm a 60-year-old man with hair growing out of my ears, so it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks,
I hear you. So I got to ask you a question. Why does hair grow out of the ears? Do you know? Because I have no idea.
It stopped growing on the top of my head,
better?
But I wish they could transplant it from the back of my ears to the top of my head, because it's it grows like there's no tomorrow, in that area. So, but
I don't get it.
Yeah, that may be our next million. We'll develop a technique for transplanting hair from the back of your ears on your earlobes to the top of your head,
Well, that would be exciting if it could get discovered in the city of Yonkers. That would be a thrill.
Yeah, there you go, right?
That would
Yonkers
be a moneymaker. Well, that's cool. So tell us, before you go, how do people get access to the Yonkers Newswire? Where do they go to get it?
Well, there's a website, yonkersnewswire.com, and then also there's social media pages, and it's pretty much either Facebook or Twitter, what have you. You can just type in Yonkers Newswire, and you'll find where it's available. And there's more even on the social media pages than on the website. The website might produce four or five articles a day, but the social media pages, there's around a couple dozen 20. Items each day. So,
how do you find
now,
the time to post all of this? Can you think?
Well,
It's hard.
For you, Hezzy, it's hard because somebody calls you up with a tip or a story. You actually have to research it, confirm things, sit down, write it for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, and then edit your own copy, and then finally you got to post your own copy, you know. So this process of a story could take you a dozen hours. But then there's some guy named Brian Herrick that comes along. Oh, hell, look at this story Hezzy did. Boom, here's the headline. Here's the first three sentences. Boom. I look like a genius. You know what I'm saying? I'm 15, you know, I'm done in 5 minutes. You know, I just have to check the
Doctor's
review. But you had to bust your tail for 12 hours. Rue's got to roll out of his bed at 4 in the morning to cover some fire somewhere, you know what I'm saying? And then he finally gets home a couple hours later. But me, I'm just cut and paste a couple things. Boom, I look like a genius, you know. It's easy to be a news
actor.
It's not so easy to create content, you know, and unique content like you do.
Well, thank you, Mr. Harrod, the genius in the new technology. You're ahead of the game, so which is excellent. Thanks again, Brian. What a pleasure to have
you
on.
All right, take care, Hezzy. Have a good night. All
you
the best
too.
To you, too.
Be well.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, how exciting. Brian Harrod, Yonkers Newswire publisher and editor. And now we're going to move on to Gabriella Metzl. She originated the Unvarnished blog, and she is and was the publisher and editor. So we're going to welcome her. Good morning, Gabrielle. How are you?
I am wonderful, Hezzy. It's always great to be on with you. How are you this Thursday morning?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling better because you're on the show. And so I'm very excited because, you know, it's really pathetic. You know, this whole issue here in New York State with the governor, evidently, he's approached some women, I think 7 so far that have come out and said that he's approached them in a manner they did not want to be approached. They were not welcoming of his approach. And the reason I bring that up is not to repeat what ended up happening, but I've only had an opportunity to speak to other men, which is really not appropriate because, well, I couldn't find any women who want to talk about it, but you are strong enough and understanding enough, and you're the right sex to even think about it because there's a different dynamic. No, I mean that in a good way. I mean, but, you know, I don't know if men can really, I guess, understand the process where the power that be is that of a man in government or in big business, and they have an upper hand or just have a more powerful position than the woman that might be working for that firm or government. So what is the dynamic, and why is it so skewed that men have the upper hand?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Hezzy, and the way I absolutely love the way that you have just framed it, because it is a matter of abuse of power to a certain extent. That's what makes something like this difficult, and we can come back and say why do it usually does happen to women, but why do the victims of these things not come forward? And there is a significant element to it that it is power based. It's not necessarily even though there are obvious gender
sexual
lines. And so it's not necessarily this is part of what has lost steam with the Me Too movement too, that at a certain point there needs to be some sort of a difference between an unwanted advance that gets rejected and rightfully gets rejected and is never broached again, and the persistent attitude and the persistence in a power manipulation. It's the same, and this is It's a very complex issue, but it needs to be understood from the lens of a power dynamic. That whether it's Governor Cuomo or it's somebody else in a powerful position, that there is, we could even say, you know, Bill Clinton. We've been dealing with this for a significant period of time. That it's the abuse of power that's the core of it.
You know where I really learned this whole dynamic first, which actually shocked me, and that was the situation in the military. The military in the United States, it may be similar in other places and different in other places, but the U.S. military, a lot has been going on. There has been a tremendous amount of sexual abuse in the military. So when I heard that for the first time, I figured, oh, so this is what's going on. The people in power and political power in the military, the men are really coming on to the women, and the women are really not interested. But there's also, a dynamic where the men, because of their position, force themselves on women. But what really shocked me, because I didn't understand that, because I said this was the military, there were rules, there were regulations, there were standards. What really I misunderstood for the first time was there are men in the military that are raping men in the military. And that's when I realized it was not a sexual attraction, it was a power trip. And It was a huge revelation to me. I think I figured that out about 10 years ago. And I was shocked when a senator in New York State, Kirsten Gillibrand, started to recognize it, I guess after she got elected, 2 or 3 years after she got elected, and she's still in power now. But she just made a lot of headlines and never did anything about it. But so the issue is still there.
It's partly a human nature problem, and when we have those types of when we have a human nature problem, it's never going to completely go away. So when we're trying to fix social problems like that, we have to keep that in mind that there are certain ills that we're never going to be fully able to eradicate, but we can at this, even with acknowledging that we can to a certain extent say we're able to minimize it. Making that statement that this is part of human nature is not giving into the problem. It's a matter of being able to pragmatically deal with that problem, to set our goals that are in line with what we can actually achieve. So that's one of the things that is prevalent in our politics in general, not just with this specific issue, that we have a desire to completely eradicate all evils. We want to ensure 100% equality between different ethnic groups or gender. We want to make it explicitly equal. We want to have no disparity whatsoever. And the fact is that we're never going to be able to get rid of sexism. We're never going to be able to get rid of racism. We're never going to be able to get rid of economic dislocation. Those things are going to continue to be part of human society because they are profoundly human problems. But it's the way that we try and deal with those problems that needs to change.
Well, let me just differ with you on only one basis. I think all those issues that you brought up were correct, except that I know that in the military in Holland or in the Netherlands,
sure,
depending on how you want to call it, it's outlawed to actually impose yourself onto somebody else unless it's welcome. And And so it's forbidden to engage in any sexual situation, I guess, at the barracks, wherever that is, in Holland. So it's illegal there. I come from Israel, and it was outlawed there as well. It's just forbidden. And you could go to prison if you break that. So when people understand that the overriding demand of the organization that you're involved in, well, in Israel, everybody has to serve in the military. So it's not that it's necessarily a chosen profession or something that needs to be done, but it needs to be done. So that's how the military is maintained. In Holland, I don't think you have to join or you're forced to join the military, but if you do, you have to abide by these rules. Why don't we impose rules like that in the U.S. military? What's the problem?
Well, the fact is that it's not that those rules aren't necessarily on the books. I mean, I'm sure they're codified differently, but they are there. We do enforce them to a certain extent when these situations are found, and even when there are sexual misconduct cases outside of the military, we do enforce it to the best of our ability. Part of especially the issue with the broader Me Too movement and some of the alleged victims of Cuomo, it's the lack of evidence or the lack of contemporary evidence that's beyond the statute of limitations to pursue certain things. So we want to harken back to Bill Cosby. Many of the cases against Mr. Cosby were from the 1980s and the 1990s. Well, the statute of limitations is gone. And part of the reason that we have statute of limitations laws to begin with is because especially for these types of cases, the physical evidence is limited, unless there's an explicit case of rape, and it's gone through the biological testing that needs to take place to gather that evidence. There's very little. It's very or unless there are a plethora of witnesses. One of the I believe it's just one of the alleged victims of Governor Cuomo has videographic evidence associated with it. So that case of sexual harassment can be, and not assault, but sexual harassment can be taken further. But
that particular woman that has the video, how old is the video?
I unfortunately am not aware of, but
okay,
it's relatively recent.
It's still valid right now. It's not like it's the statute of limitations are over. But that's the question.
Right.
Here's someone that has video. Go ahead. Sorry.
But part of the reason for statute of limitations is because not only because of the lack of physical evidence problem, but when you lack physical evidence, you too rely on between victim testimony and witness testimony. And unfortunately, the human I can't remember the exact date of the video of one of the victims of Governor Cuomo. The human memory is very bad. So it degrades over time, and the number of times that we retell a story, it influences the way that we perceive the story. The number of times that we retell a story changes what our memories are. That is a scientifically verifiable thing. So one of the things that I'm working on right now, there are a lot of different new types of technological evidence that are coming into case, especially in cases dealing with human trafficking and sexual assault in general, where it does have to rely so heavily on victim testimony that, well, can we rely upon text message, especially in the human trafficking space? Can we rely on text messages? Can we rely on other AI technologies, things of that nature, to cover that gap between victim testimony and witness testimony and things of that nature? So bottom line is that this is a difficult problem that is being worked on slowly, from whether it's the cultural angle or within the justice system itself.
Well, it seems that it's taking too long to disseminate that there are options other than physical evidence in case there was, let's say, no condom engaged. So there's no physical evidence that may be there. So that becomes, so we know that in the past that's the only way to have gotten a conviction, assuming could be proven. Even then, it was really a lousy job that they did. They bungled it up somehow or another. It's ridiculous. And even we talk about artificial intelligence right now or electronic communication, that might be all good. But, you know, there's an old standard, and that standard was in case you were assaulted in any way, whether it be physical assault, whether it be sexual assault or any other way, the point is you could sit down and write it out on a piece of paper, make copies, duplicate copies of all of that, mail it to yourself. So you mail one for yourself, you mail one for a future judge, you mail one for your lawyer, you mail another one as well for another, and that costs, what, 57 cents or 55 cents a stamp, and the cost of making photocopies, and God forbid you need to bring that up or you want to bring that up in a case. You just show that letter to the judge. Say, here, judge, it's in a sealed envelope. As you could see, it's dated, just like they did on Miracle on 34th Street. That's the only logical and legal way of sending in notices. And that also eclipses retribution, because a lot of people are afraid even to go to the police department because the police might end up talking to somebody and tell them what's going on.
Well,
so
it's
why
not even,
don't we teach that to our population?
You're absolutely right, but I would push back a little bit on the fact about the police, that first of all, it's difficult for these types of misconduct to be taken seriously in a criminal setting. The criminal justice system is, and I think that it's rightly designed to in some ways protect criminals. If we have the power, the immense and awe-inspiring power of the state coming down upon the individual, the accused, we have to ensure that we're using that power effectively, but also morally. That power of the state needs to be restrained to protect the rights of the accused. I'm all for that, but at the same time, that comes at a cost. It comes at a significant cost of re-victimizing the victim, and as somebody who's had to deal with the justice system in that type of capacity, not in a sexual misconduct case, but other things, that it does re-victimize. You have to justify to the official that you're coming in contact with why you are a victim, why they need to take you seriously, and that alone. Is a tremendously difficult process, being able
then
to convince somebody that you should take it seriously.
But if you write a letter to yourself and you mail it to yourself, you don't have to be re-victimized because you're not telling anybody. But if you decide it's self-victimization if you tell yourself your own story. Maybe you write about
that? Well, no. That I think it is potentially valid, and they're coming to grips with it being labeled as a victim, whether it's yourself or a system. That does have consequences. It does have an emotional toll. I'm not going to deny that.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you come with if it's 10 years later, 10 years down the line, again, with the statute of limitations, they might not even be able to do anything about it, even if you have
okay.
So you need to make even if you have that a letter for physical evidence, but or memory evidence. But regardless of that for a moment, even if you have that piece of evidence, even if you take, you have to get somebody within the system to take you seriously. Even if you have that documentation, you need to have somebody take you seriously.
So who's in the system? The police department?
Whether
who's
it's
in the system?
And you go through that process multiple times. It's the police department who takes you in. It's the judge who's originally hearing your case. If there's a public defender or a public advocate involved, you need
to
get them to understand too. So those types of hurdles, it puts you through a rigmarole. Not to mention, so that's just the legal side of it, if there is anything that can be done legally. But if you're talking about whether it's in a political situation, whether it's in a governor's office, or if it, and by the way, that I would also point out that a governor is obviously it's the highest official within a state government. It's the highest single official. But I would also point out that the governor of New York is a powerful, regardless of the specific person of Andrew Cuomo, who is. I loved your article on comparing Julius Caesar to Cuomo. I think that was an excellent analysis. But taking aside for a moment, the specific person of Andrew Cuomo, the office of the governor of New York is a profoundly powerful in the United States of America,
mm-hmm.
to begin with. Not only because of your size, but whether I've just four United States presidents out of the 46 that we've had have come from the governor's office of New York. That doesn't even include vice presidents and secretaries of state, things of that nature, ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
New York is a powerful state politically, so you have to take that into consideration too. If we're talking about these types of cases, that you're not just coming, you have to take into consideration if it is a relationship of power that is being abused in these types of cases, you have to consider all of the power of the office.
But is there a response, for example, if a woman who has been assaulted and needs to tell her story before the time of limitations are over? What's her name? Gloria Allred? She's like a specialist in this, but it doesn't have to necessarily be her. Can a woman approach another woman on such an intimate assault, which, well, maybe
sure.
it's camouflaged as intimate. It may be intimate for one, but not intimate for the other, or not even intimate for either, because it's unwanted. So is it also difficult for a woman to tell a woman what happened?
I
think it's difficult
so.
For
yeah.
a man to tell another man what happened, too.
I think it's difficult to speak about in general. It's so it depends upon a relationship that you have with
yeah.
that person, if you're just trying to confide. But there's a big difference between talking to a friend in confidence to emotionally work through an issue, and then also trying to act on that, right? There's a big difference between trying to unpack the emotional issues yourself with a trusted confidant, and then trying to seek retribution for those things. Two profoundly different topics.
Right. So what happened in this particular situation where there was one woman that came out and said she was assaulted one way or the other. Don't know her particular story because they've all meshed into one. Because I guess I'm not really interested in what he did, but evidently the women are saying he did something that was inappropriate. I do believe the women. I also believe the governor. And I don't know how to meld this into a legal issue. But then the one woman that came out, she ended up having to expose herself to maybe, you know, the retribution in one way or another. But then it was interesting that a second woman came out, and then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, and we're up to seven. What caused all those women to feel the cloak of retribution was could be eclipsed because someone suggested, hey, this is what happened to me. And she intimated, in a sense, by her conduct, if it happened to you, it wouldn't have been appropriate either. So I guess she got support from other women who said, hey, it happened to me and it was wrong. So where do we go from this?
Well, one of the things that's important to recognize in this is that there's strength in numbers. When you don't feel that you're alone in this, it makes it easier to talk about. It makes it easier to address it. If you're thinking that this is alone, there's also and this is true of whether it's a harassment situation, which I believe is the majority of cases against Governor Cuomo, or if it's a relationship assault within a different, whether it's an assault case or even if it's victims of sex trafficking, there is mm-hmm. a guilt complex associated with it. There is this is somehow my fault. Whether it's just the more natural tendency for females to internalize these types of things or what. Especially in a power relationship where such as the Governor Cuomo case, where it is an immense power that you're also dealing with, you take it on yourself somehow. And so when it comes to the fact that there are multiple people who are coming across who are saying that no, this wasn't my fault, then you have you end up realizing, okay, maybe it wasn't my fault from the beginning, so that's part of what leads to the cascade. The problem becomes that it turns into, well, I can to get onto the bandwagon, right? Especially when it becomes a popular issue to deal with these types of things, then it starts to conflate. The first case might be a very egregious sexual assault, where the latter cases down the line are, well, he asked me out twice and I didn't want to be asked out more, you know, I didn't want that. And there are differences, and it does matter what is actually done to determine the degree of severity. The minutia in these types of cases are significantly important when trying to figure out what exactly needs to be taken.
That's really brilliant, very well expressed. Is there a relationship, for example, when you have the situation that's alleged against the governor, and you got so many people who have said, well, this is his conduct. Does that relate also to human trafficking? Is the situation similar there, where the women that are victimized also feel guilt as if they didn't do enough or are guilty to have submitted to what ended up happening? And why do women blame themselves? if they've been put upon?
That's a great question. To connect to human trafficking for a moment, and sex trafficking specifically, there's that type of dynamic. The relationship of power still exists, and it is important, whether it's between and most of the time it's between a victim of trafficking and the pimp who is the trafficker who is making the exchanges on her behalf, and there's always an element of coercion to it, that's part of the legal standard. If we're talking about trafficking, then there has to be an element of coercion, and that's defined. But when it's not just a matter of physical coercion. It is a matter of psychological.
Right.
One of the prominent tactics between a trafficker and a victim of trafficking is also the guise of a romantic relationship. That this is somehow part of something that can be considered love, and that's very powerful. Yes, and it's abusive, and it's mentally scarring, and so that is at its extreme. But at the core of all of these issues is about a balance of power, and it's not just necessarily between men and women, because males can be victims of sex trafficking as well, especially minors. But when we're dealing with these types of issues, it's important to recognize that victims, we can point and say, well, why didn't you come out sooner? Why didn't you say this, that, and the other thing? And it has significant legal consequences. But so at certain points, a victim has to be able to recognize in themselves that it's okay to speak, that they have to recognize that they have been victimized, and that's a significant problem, especially with sex work and sex trafficking, involuntary sex work, that the victim doesn't realize that they're fully a victim.
I never thought of that at all, so that went right over my head. Never noticed it. I do recognize, though, after we did the few radio broadcasts about military sexual assault, men against women, all of a sudden I got calls from psychologists and psychiatrists that said men go through the same process. And they were... I don't know if they were concerned about retribution, but they would not admit for years that it happened to them, because supposedly they thought that is not a normal situation. And they said they were not gay, and they never asked for it.
Sure.
So, and many of them still suffer in their 50s and 60s and 70s or however old they are. They can't seem to get rid of it. Not that they aren't functioning. It's just that they'll never forget. I'm wondering, and this is a really tough question, if the dynamic was changed, if the governor of the state of New York was a woman, could the dynamic of a male imposing himself on a woman be, you know, turned upside down, where a woman would consider doing that to a man? Or is that really, this, even though it's a power, it could be a power trip, but it could all, and I don't want to make it seem like it's a physical desire, a relationship. It may be just simply a power trip. Will that happen as well? And what is it that makes it different for a woman in power, maybe not to impose her will on a man, whereas a woman might feel that the man can impose upon her. Why does a woman let it happen? Can a woman stop it? And what's holding a woman back?
Those are all excellent questions. I think in terms of women in power, of abusing power in that way especially, that it's an excellent question. I don't honestly know. In some ways it might be a very profoundly personal thing, and it, maybe we just don't have enough knowledge of it, I'm sure. But the tendency to abuse power might just manifest itself in different ways.
Does it manifest more in men than it does in women? Do we know?
I think that the tendency to abuse power is a non-gendered human problem. But whether it manifests itself in sexual misconduct or not, maybe there are some correlations. That's a very interesting question, and I would have to. I think that it would be best to have data on it, which I don't think that we do. I don't think anybody has posed that type of question before. So that's your insights today are just profound, Hezzy. But
you just got me in I guess in the palm of your hand. I don't know. I think it's all the marriage counseling work we do. It's your show.
It is your show. You're the one who's paying the bill, Tezzy, and who's getting and who's getting the big bucks to do this. It's your show,
okay.
but in terms of it's difficult. It's a profoundly difficult question because it is so personal. When we're dealing with these types of things, in terms of your second question, why can women prevent it? That's a very difficult question to answer, and I don't think that there is a right answer, but it does boil down to
if a woman is working for a Harvey Weinstein, and she wants a job in a film, why does she tolerate that abuse, physical abuse? Is that the only job available? Why doesn't she say, see ya, and goodbye? And that's the same thing that happens in the governor's office. If the governor did what those seven women said, or one of those seven women have said, then if they walk out, they could lose the money that they earn and the power that they also seek. So what keeps people there and say, I'm out of here?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I love that you brought up the Weinstein cases. That there's a difference when we're talking about politics. If you're trying to get a job in a movie situation, any type of theatrical role or anything, it's easier to transition out and say, no, I'm going to go to a different director that doesn't have this reputation. I'm going to use different connections. I'm going to those types of things. There are more options. If you're trying to make a political career and you're in the state of New York and you want to work in the executive branch, you're going to have to deal with Cuomo, right? So there's only one avenue to a certain extent. The government is a monopoly. It's one of the basic definitions
of one
government. Yes.
It's one government.
So that's part of the issue there too. When you're dealing with that's also the same if you're trying to if we want to go back and compare to Bill Clinton, right? Whether it was his instances as the governor of Arkansas or in the president of the United States, right? There's there's a limited number of places that you can go to work in government. Especially if you want to deal with an executive. If you're working in Congress and this happens in Congress, you can go back and forth.
Well, I understand what you're saying. So then, okay, let's forget about the governor's office or other offices of tremendous power that are unique. So there is no other option. You say, well, if I'm not going to work for Governor Cuomo, am I going to be able to get a job in New Jersey? I don't live in New Jersey. So that's the only game in town. Why then does a woman who probably does know the score, maybe they don't, I don't know, and is there a way to find out what the score is if you go to a Harvey Weinstein? Why would you go there if there are other producers who have a better relationship? Because what happens to the Me Too generation that says no? Because I don't hear anything from them.
And that's part of, I think, the reason why Me Too might have lost a little bit of steam when you're dealing with very different types of cases that mix together.
I didn't know that.
I hope I brought some clarity. If only I ran the world, things would be so much easier.
I'm waiting.
It'd be easier for me and probably nobody else. But that's the issue. It's a very complicated. I keep saying that it's a very complicated thing, and when we deal with it, the minutia of these cases, the actual circumstance, we question, well, was this just this instance of regret, or was this there might be a power relationship involved, but they're ultimately it's a matter of coercion is where you have no choice, right? And there might, even though there's a power relationship and there's an abuse of a power relationship, does that meet the standard of coercion where there's no choice in the matter, where there's no choice
There may have been no coercion in the case of a Harvey Weinstein, but there could be a form of coercion in sense with the governor.
Sure. And again, okay. It depends upon the specific. Cases. It really depends upon the specific cases, because I think there were certain situations with Weinstein, if I'm remembering correctly, where it was more of a forced assault, where there was no time to make the choice to leave. So I'm not going to directly make that comparison, but the details in these types of things matter. And when part of the reason why Me Too somewhat lost its steam is that these cases are complicated, and when it goes again to the idea that, well, not all of these cases have the same merit, that undermines the entirety of the movement to a certain extent. And also, if we're talking just about why it lost public steam, the American public, people in general, but the American public is a very short mind, very short memory, very short attention span. We like to move on to things quickly, and that's part of the problem with the 24/7 news, and social media that those exacerbate it. But we've always had that kind of problem. We like to move really fast, and so. That contributes to the demise of these types of public movements.
You know, I think we've really touched on a very important subject, and hopefully next time we talk, we can continue. We've only got 60 seconds left. Very, very compelling. Your insight is just absolutely brilliant, and it escapes me. I thought I was really quite sensitive, evidently not as much as I thought. So I'm going to blame you for it next time we speak to the marriage counselor. However, in the meantime, I'm going to just, lick my wounds and wait for 2 weeks from now. And there might be other things to talk about, maybe about this. So So thanks again for your input. Absolutely brilliant. Very, very
always
sensitive.
My pleasure.
And for such a young individual, I don't understand. I must be 50 years older than you, and I still haven't gotten it, but you already do. I'm just shocked.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. You
well,
flatter
you
me.
Stay well. Thank you very much. Gabriella Metzl, the Unvarnished blog publisher and editor, and brilliant individual on top of that. All the best.
Hi, Hezzy.
Stay safe.
Thank you, Hezzy. Goodbye.
Thank you. Be well. Goodbye. And that's it for us, folks. We'll speak to you tomorrow. All the best. Goodbye.